With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode of Stock Club is brought to you by Hyundai. Restart your journey towards a greener world with Hyundai's next generation of zero-emission cars. Find out more about their range of electric vehicles and the savings they can bring to your company and employees at Hyundai.ie. Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. In this episode, we're talking about Shopify becoming our first 20-bagger, the reason why we don't give stock tips, and which FANG stock we would invest $15,000 in to hold for the next 15 years. So guys, we're into week 15 of working from home. The end is in sight though, Rory. The barbers are opening up next week and I heard you've already booked your appointment.
Yeah, I was right in there. Got the first appointment they had going. It's really gotten out of hand now, to be honest. It's become kind of like almost Wham-esque. It's, without any of the kind of like preening that would come along with that.
I don't think you have the tan.
Is there any truth in the rumors, Rory, that your hair is joining forces with James's hair and starting its own blog?
we're going to become a Wham tribute band.
Yeah.
Emmett, are you ever going to go back to a barber's? Are you just going to keep DIYing it?
Excuse me, this is absolutely styled. Self-styled. Yeah, I will. I'll go back, but I'll go back when coronavirus is under control. I have no interest in a stranger who's just rubbed 10 heads before me going near me at all for now. So I'm going to keep with the DIY plan for the moment.
So let's move on to more important stuff. So we're recording this episode of Stock Club just a few days earlier than usual. Because of this, we're going to talk about some of the recent daily insights published in My Wall Street instead of covering the news and kind of talk a little bit more about them. I want to start off today, though, by giving us all a big pat on the back, because last week, Shopify became the first company in the My Wall Street shortlist to become a 20-bagger or to grow 20-fold in value. Rory, I'll come to you first. How significant is this Shopify growing by this amount?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things, you know, everyone's always looking for the next Netflix is probably the one we get asked for most of the time. You know, what's going to be the next Netflix? And anyone who tells you they know the answer to that is just lying to you. You know, there's so much of an element of kind of trying to find a range of good companies, a bucket of good companies. And out of those good companies, some of them will just blow it out of the park, you know, and it comes back to that phrase that Jeff Bezos used when he was describing how they innovate at Amazon, which is that, you know, if you're a baseball player and you step up to the bat, you get four strikes and that's it. Whereas if you're an investor, you get to strike away. And if you ever get a chance to hit a 1 in 100, you know, you should take that bet all the time, you know, and that's kind of our attitude towards investing. We like to find as many great companies as we can. We try to invest across, you know, at least 10 of them, possibly more. And you'll find those big winners. So, you know, if you maintain that kind of discipline and keep looking for great businesses, you're going to find a great winner at some point. And this happens to be our first one, and long may continue.
Yeah, absolutely. So can we just kind of chart the journey of Shopify since we added it, I think, in September 2016. And it was, I think a lot of people were saying at that time it had been on quite a run and it might have been overvalued, which is a question we get in here quite a lot about Shopify. Is it the company itself or has the world's landscape changed and has it been influenced by recent coronavirus necessities and things like that?
Well, someone was reframed the term overvalued as having access to cheap capital, which I think is a nice way of looking at things. You know, if you've got expensive stock, I mean, you can raise a lot of money very cheaply, and that helps your business grow. And, you know, I mean, it's not just that, you know, Shopify is an incredible business with an incredible team behind it. The CEO did an interview with Shane Parrish from the Knowledge Project a couple of years ago, which is still one of my favorite ever podcast I've ever listened to, one of the best interviews I've listened to in years. He's just a visionary guy with, and you know, they kind of came in at the right time as well. They are part of what Ben Thompson calls the anti-Amazon alliance of businesses that don't want to see Amazon just control the entire e-commerce landscape. And they're offering some people something different as well. You know, there isn't consumer trends are changing where people want, you know, they don't want the one size fits all offer that Amazon particularly has. They want, you know, to buy from smaller companies, get more of a kind of personalized experience when it comes to shopping. And you know, we always like one of the things we always look for when we're investing companies that I know I'm always interested in investing in them, and I think you too, are companies that empower entrepreneurs to go out there and create new great businesses. And there's loads of companies in our shortlist like that: Shopify, Wix, PayPal, Square, all these businesses that are basically helping smaller businesses grow and expand their base. And Shopify just happened to be that company that was there at the right time and doing the right thing.
Absolutely. Emmett, coming to you then, so you've been in the investing game for quite a while now. How often is it you see growth like this in a company in just 4 years?
It's very rare, James. And in fact, I just have to credit Rory, because Shopify went into the My Wall Street app at Rory's sponsorship, I was going to say insistence, and it would have gone in sooner had I listened to Rory sooner. So I think our 20 bagger could have been a 25 or 30 bagger. These are rare events to happen in such an accelerated fashion. To see a 20 bagger in 4 or 5 years is a very rare thing. I look at my own personal portfolios. I have a couple of different brokerage accounts, and my oldest one, which is with TD Ameritrade, has as most of my big winners in it, and all of the stocks in there that are up over tenfold have been hanging around my life for at least 10 years. So to see a 20 bagger in 4 years is unusual. And I have a 14-year-old son who bought Shopify back when, and he's up 21-fold actually. He must have bought on a dip, I think he probably bought on a dip.
He must have listened to Rory before he listened to you.
Exactly. And I'm actually delighted he's learned about the transformative power of investing. And equally, I don't like the idea that he thinks that money comes this easy, because it is quite a rare thing. I mean, we have maybe 105 or 110 stocks in our My Wall Street app, and we're now talking about the absolute biggest winner. But it is actually, it's a great thing. And to elaborate on something that Rory said, is that great businesses rarely ever look cheap. They just always look too expensive. And I can remember standing in a Starbucks store in San Francisco in 1999 or the year 2000, and looking at their shares afterwards and thinking it was the most preposterously overvalued coffee shop I'd ever seen in my life. That honor now goes to Lookin, but it turns out that that Starbucks was it was a great buy then. And you know, I think Shopify now is, for a long-term investor, a wonderful addition to their portfolio. I'm sure it's had a 20x growth, but its brightest days are probably still ahead.
Well, you've just answered the question I was going to ask. I think it's probably the most frequent question we get in from subscribers is it too late to invest in Shopify? They've been on such a great run. Have I missed the boat with Shopify? Rory, Emmett's already put out his stall. What do you think?
Well, this is one of the questions I get so often, which is that, like, it's almost like the default last question in any sort of like webinar or interview that you do, where they start listing out companies that and ask you whether you think they're overvalued. And the ones that always pop up time and time again are Shopify, Amazon, and Netflix. And the answer is always the same. You can look back through, you know, with Amazon and Netflix in particular, you can look back over the last 20 years and find me a time where everyone wasn't screaming that these businesses weren't overvalued. It just didn't exist. I think at one point in like 2014, Amazon was trading at something like 13,000 price to earnings ratio, you know, something just totally outrageous. And everyone was saying it was overvalued then, and the stock's up something like 4 or 5x since then. So yeah, look, these businesses that really break the rules and really shock us will always look overvalued. They break everyone's models, all the DCF models you can do in the world, won't ever catch them. So, you know, you can't value these businesses in traditional ways. And that's one of the lessons. You'll miss out on so many great investments if you insist on fitting everything into the kind of traditional box that everyone tries to put stocks into.
And big time. I mean, David over at The Motley Fool, David Gardner, one of the co-founders of Motley Fool in the earlier days of his rule-breaking service, one of the attributes he specifically looked for was that the stock in question was called overvalued and hyped in the media. In general, print media was shouting that this stock is overpriced. And that, for him, was a green traffic light for go. And it's like history repeating itself here in this conversation. It really is something you just see. Great businesses just never look cheap.
Yeah, we need to... something I need to get better at as well is so many times you do hold back because you think the stock is overvalued when... And then, you know, about 100% later, you're going, right, we better have it now.
Yeah, I know. It's human nature. I mean, it's so hard to divorce yourself from hindsight bias and looking at that recent graph and realizing I could have got, you know, could have got in 40% lower or 50% lower. It's heartbreaking, but it's all part of the journey.
Absolutely. So let's move on to talk about some of the daily insights then. And Rory, I'm going to come back to you. So a couple of weeks ago, you wrote a really interesting piece about why you never give individual stock tips to your family or friends. I suppose the first question I had when I read this was, is that not your job?
I suppose it kind of, well, because we don't give
what
like...
What is your job, Rory?
Okay, I don't like this conversation is going. No, I mean, it's like we don't give individual stock tips to people. So like we never like talk to a user, like if a user like writes in and says, can you tell me what stock to invest in? You know, we never do that. My family and friends kind of roll their eyes because they have to listen to me talk about investing all the time. And then when they ask me what stock to invest in, I won't tell them. But the reason I do that is like what I prefer to do is I like to tell people that like four or five different companies that at the moment I'm kind of interested in, you know, they'll usually be quite well aligned with, you know, what has been the recent stock of the month or what ones we're thinking of for our stock of the month service, and ask them to go off and just do a bit of reading about them themselves and let them come to the decision of what one they want to invest in, if it's just one. And hopefully it's not just one. Hopefully they're going to invest in a couple of businesses over the course of a couple of months. Or the alternative is to, if someone has a stock they want to invest in, to get them to pitch the stock to you. And then you can kind of see that they've done the research and you can help them out in terms of maybe they've assumed something that wasn't the case, or maybe they've not considered something like a big competitor. And that at least lets you know that when they're going to go buy the stock, that they know what they're investing in, that they're not just going off a ticker symbol that you've said. And it's such an important element of investing, because if you don't understand what you're investing in, you'll never know whether you're making the right moves or not. You'll never know. You know, if you've researched the business, you understand and you're thinking about it for the long term, a 10% drop isn't going to freak you out. You know, it's in fact, if you know the business well enough, you might see it as a buying opportunity. But how would you possibly know that if you didn't understand what the business was doing and what the leaders were about and where the business was going over the long term? We never like to use gambling as a comparison to investing, but you know, I think of investing in poker to be quite similar. If you play poker without knowing any of the rules, you might win a few hands, but it'll be purely down to luck. As you learn how to play the game and as you develop as a player, it becomes luck's still an element, but it becomes much less of an element. Skill becomes much more of an element. And if you look at like the World Series of Poker every year, there's about the same five or six guys sitting around the table. You know, you can't say poker is a game of luck. It's clearly a game of skill with an element of luck involved. And so, yeah, I think that's one of the most important things about investing. It's if you get people into investing and only kind of are giving them ticker symbols to invest in, they're never going to become good investors. I remember I was doing a webinar recently where I was talking about pharmaceuticals and how we never invest in them because we don't have the skill sets required to analyze those businesses. The side chat just like lit up with people saying, oh well, I don't know anything about pharmaceuticals, but I invested in this company and it went up 10x and I made this money. And it's like, well, good for you, but you know, the thing about investing in stocks is that they either go up or down. That's the only way they can go. And if they go up, you might think you've made a really good decision, but you haven't. Making a good decision is based on knowing what you're doing. You could drive through a red light with your eyes closed and not die. That doesn't make it a good decision. You have to. And there's a great book, I think I've talked about it before, Annie Duke, called Thinking in Bets, which she talks about resulting, which is where we base our decisions. We base whether we think decisions are good or not based on the result, whereas we should have based them on how we got to come to that decision in the first place. What was the method? So I think that's very important for investing, and it's something I try and stick to, even with my closest friends, much to their annoyance.
Yeah. When we talk about investing, usually, the obvious output of somebody starting to invest is to make money. But Emmett, I know you've often talked about as well the kind of other side effects, if you want to call them that, of investing, about like learning about new companies and new industries and I suppose about the world around you. Do you think that bleeds into this a little bit too?
Oh, very much so. I mean, investing, the end result, the output, the returns, that's just the end point. Really, your understanding, as you said, James, of the world around you, but also your own temperament and an observation of the temperament of others and trying to get deeper inside your own thought process to understand and to kind of shield yourself from groupthink, which is a very powerful effect. If you were standing in a room and with 99 other people and they all run for the exit and you don't know why, there's a very high probability you'll run too. But, occasionally that charge is not wise. And especially in the stock market, every morning, every day, we're presented with the voting machine that is the public. The market moves up or down based on everyone's vote, whether they're buying or selling shares. And as a stock investor, and as somebody in our profession, our collective profession here, we watch this a lot and we so often see the crowd running for the exit at the wrong time or running for the entrance at the wrong time. And you learn a lot about yourself. It's very hard to dedicate yourself to this pursuit and not end up reading books on psychology and mass behavior. And we've read a few books on that matter. I would say they're kind of pedestrian, they're light touch, but it's good to understand the couple of dozen human biases that exist and to be aware of them so that when it's coming at you, you don't suffer from the effects of them. So yeah, the journey of investing is one that enriches your life. It introduces you to businesses and sectors and opportunities you didn't even know existed. It will hone your skills at assessing strategies and you'll develop a working knowledge of accountancy, whether you like it or not. And all these things will actually start to lean into the other areas of your life beyond investing. And I think stock investing is for me the supreme pursuit for actually self-improvement of the mind anyway. I can't say you'll lose any weight by stock investing.
Well, there's definitely an element of discipline in it as well, isn't there? I mean, like teaching yourself the discipline to not to avoid the noise. I can't imagine how many people over the last couple of months have taken the profits and then seen stocks like Zoom and Teladoc and Shopify shoot up another 200%. They must be really kind of kicking themselves now, thinking, God, I took the profits way too early there, when if buying and hold over the long term was your stated goal, you should have just maintained that. I mean, that doesn't mean we're not headed for another correction anytime soon, but yeah, we can wait. We can wait even longer after that.
I was talking to one of our members of our community and a customer who sold at the bottom of the V, just got freaked out, and in doing so, on paper, lost millions, when in fact he should have just sat, stay put. And that's a very expensive lesson in human temperament.
A lot of people didn't they? And, it's that whole thing. It's like, oh, well, I'll buy back in when the market comes back. But it came back so fast. We're seeing all these interviews now with institutional investors who are going on CNBC saying totally missed it, didn't have the fortitude to hold or sold when I shouldn't have and didn't buy back in quick enough. And the Robinhood traders are all beating them at their own game now.
Well, that's something that people write about quite a lot, is that no crash is the same as the next one. You know, when we think of a crash up until, I suppose, the end of last year, we imagined, you know, the financial crisis, whereas, you know, nobody saw the COVID-19 crisis coming, and nobody saw the market rebounding as fast as that. And if you kind of build your plans based on something that's already happened, you can't foresee the future or what will happen coming up. Let's move on then to another daily insight you wrote recently, Rory, called The Dollar Box. This is quite vague, or you kind of pitched a question to the readers in a very vague way. Do you want to explain to us what The Dollar Box is?
Yeah, it was a question that I heard someone ask a while ago, and I thought it made me think differently about investing anyway, which was, if someone was to give you a box that prints a dollar on the 1st of January every year for the rest of time, how much would you reasonably expect to be able to sell that box for? What's a reasonable amount of money you would accept for that box? And it's a funny question, because it brings up kind of two ideas. First is the time value of money, which is obviously very important in the world of finance. The concept that a dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow. And the reason for that a lot of the time is inflation, which is something people don't really consider a lot when they're thinking about finance. They don't realize that money in their hand is becoming less valuable by the day, essentially. And so the number one kind of goal of an investor should be to protect against inflation, to make sure that you're not, to at least make sure you're not losing money. You know, what was Warren Buffett's rule? Rule number one was never lose money, and rule number two was never lose money. So that's the first thing. So if you're getting a dollar every year, that dollar is becoming less valuable as you go on. And then the other idea about a dollar today being worth a dollar tomorrow is that money has an opportunity cost. You can use money to make more money if you know what you're doing with it. And so what we promote here is, you know, well, this is kind of funner a couple of years ago when you could talk about the 4% you get from a treasury bond, or the 1% you get from your savings account, or the 10% you get from the stock market. Those first two options aren't really available to anyone at the moment. There's no interest to be getting at these low rates. But, you know, if you can use that money to make more money, then you'd want it sooner.
Yeah.
And so that's something I think people need to be aware of when they're thinking about their financial future. And also to get into the mindset of everything being an investment. You know, every dollar you spend is an investment. Whether it's a bad investment, like going out and spending hundreds of dollars on something you don't need, or it's investing in, you know, a book to teach you more about investing, or, you know, anything that makes you kind of go forward in your financial life, you have to think of that money and use that money wisely.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very valuable lesson. I remember at the time you kind of slacked everybody in the office with the position that if you had a box and an offshore dollar, and you were getting some pretty crazy answers back.
Yeah, I know. You can go so deep into it as well. You know, anyone who's retiring anytime soon will probably be being offered an annuity, which is essentially the exact same thing, which is a contract that pays you a certain amount of money every year that you have to pay up front for. So it's a decision what you're going to do with your pension money. And that's a decision that everyone has to make at some point. They have to decide how they're going to put this money to work for them going forward. A lot of people will go down another route, like income investing, so buying into dividend paying stocks. You know, we've got some great dividend paying stocks, and the app should pay you 4-5% a year, and you can, you know, make capital on that. So that's something everyone has to figure out as they get older. It's I suppose not as much of a decision for the younger investor, usually looking for capital expansion rather than income. But yeah, it's all about the concept of thinking about all the money you bring in as an opportunity to improve your financial well-being over the long term.
Yeah, absolutely. And every single dollar you make is an investment decision to make. So don't forget that you can read those daily insights, as well as the brand new ones that we post every day in the My Wall Street app right now. Let's take a look at some of the other things happening in My Wall Street too at the moment. So far this month, we've already published June's Stock of the Month report and the Stock of the Month podcast. Both of these are exclusive features for My Wall Street subscribers and can be accessed in the app right now. We also have a brand new stock edition. This is a digital gaming and e-commerce company that I'll bet most listeners haven't heard of. The new stock is already up more than 20% since we picked it. So although we don't celebrate short-term winners, it's definitely a nice bump to get. Remember, if you're not a member of the My Wall Street community, you can just sign up right now and get a free trial by clicking on the link in the notes for today's show. One last thing I want to mention before we move on is that on Wednesday, Emmett held his first ever Master Investing workshop. If you missed it, the replay is available for a limited time only at horizon.mywallstreet.com/webinar. In this workshop, Emmett brings you into his home office for a start to finish look at everything he does when deciding on what stock he's going to buy next for the Horizon portfolio. In just 60 minutes, you can walk away knowing how to use the same tools and strategies that Emmett uses day in, day out to consistently pick outperforming stocks. The replay is only available until this Sunday, June 28th, so go to horizon.mywallstreet.com/webinar to watch it before it's too late. I'll include the link in the notes for today's show too. Let's go to Jargon Busters then. So Emmett, I'm going to come to you first. And this question comes from Dara, who asked about allocating money to stocks in your portfolio. How do you divide your equity out amongst the stocks you already hold in your portfolio? And are there any strategies you should keep in mind when doing so?
Yeah, so dollar cost averaging is an approach made by most kind of successful investors where they continue to add new funds to stocks that they own and particularly like. So there's a couple of approaches you can take. Well, obviously, stage one is you build a portfolio. So if you're going from zero to one, I think what we would advocate is don't reinvest until you've started, till you have some diversity in your portfolio. And we say people should really aim to have around 12 different stocks in their portfolio within about a year, at which point then you have the quality problem that Dara described there. And I think the best investments that I've made have probably been adding new money to existing stocks in my folio. Now, I've never had a rule that is just I will add X amount to all my stocks at a fixed point every month. I'll usually take a view on the way I did it is it has not been, I suppose, extensively documented as the right way to do it. But I'm going to tell you how I've done it, which you can take with a pinch of salt. And that is I had for very, very many years a notion of what a full position was, and just for easy number's sake, let's just say it's $1,000, and I have 12 stocks all worth $1,000 more or less. If I still liked the stock when it went down, I top it back up to $1,000 when I had the cash. And it was a simple methodology for me to kind of buy on dips when I had the cash available. Then I had a second kind of swim lane, if you like, in my thinking, which was that I will double down on those I like the most. So it wasn't a simple approach where I just decided to add an extra $50 to all my 12 stocks every month, which, by the way, is a very, very good approach. But I guess there's no digital answer or binary answer for Dara's question. You know, Alec, allocating money to the stocks in your portfolio is it's analogous, if you ask me, to like venture capital funds will invest in a whole range of companies. And it's like if you had a kind of a garden or a lawn that was dried out and all the grass in it was yellow and you water it, you'll see patches of green appear. And it's actually adding water to the green patches. You actually can see where the life is. And in your own portfolio, you'll start to see stocks that are outperforming the others. They should not be ignored. They should get more capital. And we've made that point already. And then there's those that you think if you still believe their strategy is intact, they've gone on sale and you add to those too. So I'm not being really prescriptive in my answer to Dara's question. It's like buy more of the ones you love. And if other ones go below your buy price and they are still the same business doing the same thing with the same opportunity, consider adding to it as well.
I think an important point you hit on there, though, is the consistency that's needed. And it's that, you know, you need to consistently put money aside into your brokerage account, at least whether you invest in the stocks or not, but just have that money, if possible, consistently flowing into the account.
Through thick and thin, that is the differentiating factor between a good and an outstanding portfolio. And anyone I know of who's built an outstanding portfolio has just maintained a discipline of adding some money, a little money often. It's far more powerful than starting with a lot of money. And the math behind this, the economics behind this are proven out and played out and modeled umpteen times. But if you just start, you know, as best you can, but just commit yourself to doing it regularly, the mathematics of that approach are far more powerful, far, far more powerful and transformative than just starting with a lot of money and doing it once.
Cool. The next question comes from James Cicero, who tweeted us and asked our thoughts on option trading. So I suppose what we want to know is, what is option trading? Is it a good idea? And especially given the current market conditions at the moment. Rory, I might throw that over to you.
Yeah, I mean, well, Emmett, you have more experience with option trading certainly than I would, but option trading is, you know, when you're option trading, you're not buying stock in a company. What you're buying is a financial derivative, essentially a contract that will allow you to buy, in terms of a call option, would allow you to buy a stock at a certain price in the future. The big difference, you know, a lot of people would say investing in stocks rather than options means you're leaving a lot of money on the table, because you can leverage yourself using options. But the downside is that you're putting a time limit on your investment. So you're predicting that the stock is going to move a certain way over a certain amount of time. Whereas with long-term buy and hold investing, you know, you're giving yourself a lot more leeway in terms of letting the strategy play out over the long term. You want to add anything to that? You've been through the options game a bit more than I have.
I have, yeah. And I think you touched on all the points there, Rory. The real crux of it is what you said there. If you're going into an options world, you are long-term buy and hold ceases to exist as a strategy for an option, because it's time bound. It has that third dimension. It isn't just finding the stock you love and buying it, or you're actually betting on it, because it has an outcome at a fixed point. So if you go to a horse race, you pick a horse, it goes around the track, and when it crosses the line, the race is over. And that line in the world of options is a date that is pre-decided between you and the person who's buying the option from you, or selling, or who you're selling the option to. So the thing about options is, if you're going to use them, and they do have a very very, very strong economic function, and we're not here to say that options are a bad thing. It just requires a different discipline and a different approach. And there are tomes written about option strategies, and they all make sense. Now, you need to have a reasonably good head on your shoulders to understand the different strategies that you can apply, and be quite good at reading the graphs that those options imply. But there are some really great options out there, like covered calls. If you decided you're just going to exit position, and you can write a covered call, or if you believe, you know, writing puts are you know, there's different strategies you can take. And I think as a team here, we've often thought about producing something more in depth on that. But it is a rabbit hole. You know, it's a whole new pursuit, and it can bolster your folio's returns, or it can very much crimp them. But yeah, it's a different pursuit, but it has its role in society. And by the way, options have been around for as long as humankind, and the origins of options goes right back to Damascus, where you could go and get the promise of bags of salt, as far as I know, at a fixed price for the year ahead if you paid the vendor a certain amount of money. Now, so he took money off you now, he or she took money off you now, and the promise that they would sell you bags of salt at a fixed price for the year ahead. And that, I think, is the kernel of the options market, where you paid someone for the right but not the obligation to buy this commodity off them at a fixed price in the future. And then every variation of what I've just explained there kind of bubbled up as the years went by.
I thought we were going to go down the podcast version of a Wikipedia hole there. The next question is actually related to the question about options, and it comes from Mark. And he asks us about short ratios. So he was talking specifically in terms of Match Group, who have quite a high short ratio. So do we pay attention to them when considering an investment, and do they matter? Rory.
Yeah, I actually do read up on them quite an awful lot. There's I think FinViz is the website that you can get quite a lot of information on stocks, and they produce a short ratio. The short ratio is basically just giving you an idea of how many investors are betting against the stock. So as we've discussed many times before, you can be long a stock or short a stock. So the short ratio is what percentage of float is being shorted, or sometimes it's expressed as how many days it would take for the short holders to cover their positions. So there's two different ways you can look at it. There's one of the reasons I kind of looked at is quite interested in companies that are heavily shorted. It goes back to the conversation we had at the start of this podcast, where companies that are widely overvalued tend to be heavily short. Or when people say that this company is massively overvalued, you know, and you can find them being heavily shorted. Yeah. And it's an interesting kind of strategy, because a company that's heavily shorted if they get kind of some good news, what you can find is they have a short, what's called a short squeeze, where the people who are short the stock, in order to cover their position, have to buy the stock, which is just one of the mechanisms of shorting a stock, is that you're borrowing it off someone. And so in order to cover your position, to close out your position, you have to buy the stock to return it to the original owner. And that causes a massive spike in the price, which is called a short squeeze. So it's a risky enough strategy in terms of what you're doing is you're basically betting against, if you're investing in companies that are heavily shorted, you're betting against the greater community. But what you can do is you can definitely see kind of short-term spikes in price whenever they release kind of a good earnings report or some good news comes out about them.
I think you said once before, Rory, that the real danger with shorts is that, you know, if you invest in a stock, the worst it can do is fall to zero. Whereas if you short a stock, there's no limit or there's no ceiling on how high a stock can go, which means how much you pay for the stock.
Yeah, I mean, in practice, that'll probably never happen because when, again, through the mechanism of shorting, what you're doing is you're borrowing from your broker and your broker will probably close out your position for you before that happens. But we've seen some examples in the past of companies that were very heavily shorted that were out of nowhere acquired, for example, and the stock shot up, you know, 60-70%, you know, losing 70% over the course of an evening when the market's closed can be quite painful for an investor. Particularly if you then also owe that money back to your broker.
Absolutely. So I'll come to the last question now. So this question might be more specific to our Irish and our UK listeners. Rob got in touch with us asking about currency fluctuation and any strategies we might have for covering the loss in investing in dollar stocks from euro. Emmett, I'll throw this over to you because I think this is something you've some experience with.
Yeah. So we here in Europe are in the Eurozone and we are investing in the US stock market and therefore investing with US dollars. And the currency fluctuation issue, if you look at the long-term cyclicality, the exchange rate between euro and dollars, over the very long term, you will out-invest that. So if your portfolio is returning below the S&P 500, which is let's say 9% per year compounded over the long term, there's no way that you're going to lose out to that kind of return by buying a currency. A currency generally exchanges within a predictable trading range. So I guess my point is that over the long term, you will out invest currency fluctuations.
Yeah.
I always ignored it. And it's a bit like dollar cost averaging. I just bought US dollars when I had euros to do so, and over the very long term it had a smoothing effect. In fact, with DCA, dollar cost averaging math, that actually worked out better, which I won't go into now, but by just buying dollars when you have the cash available and getting it done, over and done with and getting on with it, is over the very long term your best bet.
So it's something that long-term investors don't have to worry about. It's more of a short-term concern, really.
Entirely. Now, at the far end, in the autumn of your life, where you're looking at a multi-million dollar portfolio and you decided I'm cashing in, I'm bringing this home and I'm buying the island or the boat or whatever it is that you wish to do, that is probably where you really want to do the best you can do. And really, that's anyone's guess. Really, you only live once. You got to bring the cash home when you've got it. So that's the far end of the conveyor belt.
Absolutely. Right, so that was Jargon Busters. We'll move on to the elevator pitch now. This week's elevator pitch comes in from a listener, Keith, who asked, if you had $10,000 to invest and hold for 15 years in any one of the FANG stocks, so that's Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix or Google, which would you choose? I'm going to enhance this question a little bit by adding in Microsoft, first of all. So we'll have Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Microsoft or Google. And I'm also going to ask, as well as which one you would invest and hold for 15 years, which one you would not invest in and hold for 15 years. So two parts to that question there. Rory, I'll come to you first. Go with the one you'd invest in first.
Yeah, I mean, out of all of those, I think my answer is always Amazon. I just think, Amazon is a company that people kind of forget that this was built by one person over the course of the last 25 years, has become an absolute behemoth. And you know, Jeff Bezos left a high-paying job in Wall Street to move his family to Seattle and set up Amazon. And you know, he had the vision to see what I'm sure, like, well, I'm sure plenty of people saw, but not to the extent that he did, and has, you know, is a self-made richest man in the world, has had so many successes, you know, taken on so many giants as well. I think people forget that, you know, Amazon was first taken on Borders in the book game, and then Radio Shack in the DVD game, and then now Walmart in the grocery game, and it just comes out top every single time with Kindle and Prime and AWS. You know, just an incredible visionary. And if there's one person I'd happily hand my money over to put to good use, it would be Jeff Bezos.
What's that saying? You won't get fired for picking Amazon.
No one gets fired for picking Amazon. that was the old Wall Street adage. No one ever gets fired for picking Amazon.
Emmett, I'll come to you then. Which company would you pick to invest in and hold for 15 years?
So we love founder-led companies. And when we look at Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google, and Microsoft, we know the lads at Google are still involved. Facebook, Mark is still involved. Mark Zuckerberg, of course, the CEO, founder. And of course, we've Jeff Bezos at Amazon. So I'm going to, and Reed Hastings at Netflix, of course. But I'm going to agree with Rory. I just think Amazon is it's the juggernaut. It's the future.
Short and sweet. Right. So, Emmett, I'll stay with you then. So which company would you be least likely to invest in out of them? This is probably the more interesting one to find out about.
It's far easier for me to answer this one, because when I gave the answer for Amazon, I was also Apple, you know, who could argue against Apple? But for me, I just wouldn't invest in Facebook. And I invested 95% of my shares in Facebook over the last couple of years, for a couple of different reasons. But I just, like, when you look at TikTok as an example, it's proven that Facebook and its companies don't have a monopoly on wildfire growth. Yeah. You know, there was Facebook, and then all the assets it bought, whether it's WhatsApp or Instagram and all those, they all grew like wildfire. Like, they just appeared in our lives. The same goes for TikTok, and something else is going to come along. And I just think that while Facebook is the dominant force in keeping people connected, it's the one that I would not buy right now. And there's a whole lot of other reasons that I won't bore the world with.
Absolutely. Rory?
Yeah, same. Definitely Facebook, out of the ones mentioned there, would be the last stock I wouldn't invest in. You know, Emmett, yeah, made some great points there about TikTok, and I think Facebook hasn't innovated the way that they used to back in the day. I think that they've become they copy an awful lot of other ideas and kind of muscle people around. And I think, you know, as a company, I think they're a net negative for the world. And Mark Zuckerberg, as much as he is a great business mind, is kind of tone deaf to what's really happening out there and how problematic what these created can be over the long term. So yeah, I wouldn't put my money behind it.
Wow. Okay. Uniformity for once across the elevator pitches. So that's it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget that there's loads of great new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment. If there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode of Stock Club, please make sure to get in touch with us. You can catch us on Twitter. That's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club if you're enjoying it. And please leave a review or a rating for us on whatever podcasting platform you listen to us on. From all of us here, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing. This episode of Stock Club is brought to you by Hyundai. Restart your journey towards a greener world with Hyundai's next generation of zero-emission cars. Find out more about their range of electric vehicles and the savings they can bring to your company and employees at Hyundai.ie.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.